This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Death may be inevitable, but what about aging? If we could figure out what biological switches get flipped to start the process of decline, could we reverse it or even prevent it? Anne Brunet is professor of genetics and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Laboratories for the Biology of Aging at Stanford University. She joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm not going to ask why we age, because I'm assuming that if you had that answer, you would be rich and none of us would have any gray hairs at this point. But what we do have at this point are what you call the nine pillars of aging. A lot of different cellular and molecular changes that we know happen somewhere kind of early in the process of aging. You don't need to go through the whole list of nine, but can you give us a sense of what some of those changes are that we know about at this point?
Yes, so there are molecular changes as well as cellular changes. So some of the molecular changes that occur during aging include change in nutrient sensing ability and metabolism in the cells, for example, mitochondria, change in activity. Some other ones include the ability of cells to express genes in the correct manner and how their chromatin is folded in an appropriate manner. So those are called epigenetic changes. Other changes include how protein are correctly folded in the cells. So when one is young, the proteins are correctly folded and in a pristine shape. And when we get older, they tend to unfold or worse, even sometimes aggregate with one another. Those are called protein homeostasis changes. So those are examples, metabolic, chromatin, and protein homeostasis, examples of the molecular changes that occur with aging. But there are also cellular changes, infiltration of immune cells, inflamed cells, stem cell decay. And those are examples at the more cellular levels of what are the changes that occur during aging.
It sounds like basically all of the basic maintenance processes at the most fundamental levels of biology just start to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all this list of, okay, these changes occur early. And in fact, there was another study just released a few days ago that found a population of stem cells in a certain part of the brain that starts to decline. And they kind of start off saying, oh, well, this, you know, controls aging. It turns out it's just, you know, another one of these early changes. Do we have any idea what's actually in control? Why does this all start to fall apart?
Yeah, so this is the great challenge of the field, is to try to understand all the changes in all different tissues and cell types, almost like having an atlas of aging. That's a big challenge of the field. Like, it's not done yet. I think this will be very interesting to understand, like, in a more systematic manner, what happens, and also, like, what are the early changes, and maybe not only the early changes, but the one that can be actionable, because some of the changes that occur might occur early, like you mentioned gray hair. Some of the this could happen early, but this may not be really actionable. It might be even if it happens early, something that is a bystanders of the aging process.
So right. it's not necessarily like you get gray hairs early, you're going to die earlier.
Yeah.
It's just kind of some of it's unlinked or something.
Yes, it's just happening. So I mean, it's nice to document what's happening, and it's so nice to understand which of the changes matter and which one can be manipulated in a way that they can perhaps be reversed or slow the process.
This is a really fascinating problem just at a purely intellectual academic level, figuring out how this works. It's kind of the other side of developmental biology, of how we develop as embryos and young children. But there's also then this really applied side. Like, if we understood it, maybe we could do something about it. What is it that drives your research and the questions that you do? Is it this desire to try to stop aging, or is it really just an academic interest?
Oh, so for us, for me, it's an academic interest. I find the process fascinating, and I feel like understanding something that decays or gets broken will give us also some really key insight that perhaps hasn't been gained yet about like how the youthful and fit system functions. So I really enjoy, and our lab really enjoys, the fundamental aspect of understanding how aging or how lifespan or longevity is regulated. It also has potential application. I know a lot of my colleagues are also very interested in this aspect, and certainly it's a societal and medical challenge. So I think it's fun to be in a field where there is both amazing intellectual pursuit, that's what we're interested in, and also potential application or ethical aspects also to consider.
I mean, you mentioned the societal and the medical aspect to this. The population in the U.S. is aging, but the experience of aging has changed a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go back maybe a century, right, the lifespan... A life expectancy has increased a lot. And we hear things like, you know, 50 is the new 40, and people are enjoying their retirement in ways that they haven't in the past. Have we figured out ways to fundamentally alter the timing of aging, or have we just figured out ways to maybe treat some of the symptoms or the illnesses that might come along with it? Have we actually delayed aging with any of our lifestyle changes or medical interventions?
Probably the rate of aging is probably still pretty similar. It's probably more a feature of the human species. But what we've really changed drastically are our lifestyle changes. And those are probably setting back almost like when the aging process starts. Of course, like treating some of the key disease has also been important, because often lifespan is measured as a group. So for sure, when you do the lifespan studies in humans, those are a congregate, if you wish, of all the both lifestyle and success of medicine, like antibiotics, vaccination, like all of those have contributed in extending or like the squaring of the lifespan curve, if you wish, of humans. That's a very interesting. I mean, we work on model organisms in our lab, but of course, now there are more and more human studies.
You mentioned the model organisms that you work on in the lab, and that's really how we know probably most of what we know about aging is from animal studies, and in some cases, not even animals. Yeast, mm-hmm. Or fruit flies, worms, mm-hmm. these little tiny short-lived mm-hmm. creatures that seem to have very little connection to humans or a very distant connection to humans. What do we learn from them, and how applicable is it to humans? How useful is it?
Well, we think that it's been amazing. It's really cracked open the field. More than 20 years ago, because those organisms are relatively short-lived, so and also like very easily manipulatable. They allow high throughput type of experiments, and they were really instrumental in cracking open which genes actually, or which pathways can regulate aging. And at the beginning, people were always wondering, of course, like aging is so complicated that one will never find like one gene that's important, but that wasn't the case, because in fact, like mutations in simple pathways or single genes even can drastically affect a lifespan in those model organisms. So that was the first worry that people had, but that turned out not to be the case. And then the second worry is the one you mentioned, that maybe something that applies to a tiny worm or yeast may not be translatable into mammals or humans. But this has also like turned out not to be the case that there wasn't a connection. In fact, there is a connection, and amazingly, a lot of the pathways, for example, the insulin, FOXO pathway, the mTOR pathway that were discovered in worms or yeast or flies, then turned out to actually also regulate lifespan or be important for aging in mammals. And there are even studies in human centenarian cohorts that indicate that variation in some of those genes are also associated with exceptional longevity in humans, or being a centenarian, for example.
Usually it takes a pretty long time to take a finding kind of a basic biology finding in a model organism. In this case, I'm thinking about a mouse, and turn that into something that you might find in a human clinical trial. Mm-hmm. But colleagues of yours at Stanford in 2014 published this study saying, if you give an old mouse a transfusion of plasma from a young mouse, you can reverse some of the memory and learning deficits mm-hmm. that are sometimes associated with aging. 3 years later, not even 3 years later, because it started last year, a private company announced, okay, we're going to do a, you know, pay-to-play clinical trial where you can come and pay us to get a one-time transfusion of a young person's blood and see if that helps with your aging process. It's been really controversial. Your colleagues at Stanford have said this is not what they intended at all. And on one hand, it seems kind of crazy. But on the other hand, I wonder, you know, what's the right way? What would have been the right way to take that finding that seemed so revolutionary and translate it into a human application?
Yeah, so in fact, Tony Wiscori, my colleague at Stanford who did this research, he has started his own company, which is called Alcahest. So the company you are referring to is the other one. It's called Ambrosia. It's a little bit complicated, but there are two companies, and one, and Tony is trying, I think, to do it the right way, which is to measure, to kind of go step by step. So go from the mice finding and then perhaps trying to see with patients that have a measurable defect in their cognitive function, for example, a mild cognitive defect, are on their way to Alzheimer's disease and they have like really significantly lower, they score significantly lower on cognitive tests, then do those trial in a more controlled manner so that one has an outcome, one does the non-treated, treated, all the controls, and understand a little bit better all the process in the meantime. So a scientific way of doing that. So I think like this is hopefully happening as well. So there is also a control way of doing things that's happening as well. So I think it will take time, but I think there will be results from those that can help in the translation process.
Exciting prospects. That's aging researcher Anne Brunet of Stanford University. Anne, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Heather Goldstone. The Geography of Pain and Hope, that's coming up next on Living Lab after a short break.